Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz. Biz is spelled B-I-Z, and it's ogc@accessradio.biz. Today's guest, who is she? Well, she is a novelist and freelance writer. Her first novel was published in 2021, and like the next three books, were about Isabella M. Smooge. Last year, her Jane Austen-inspired book, A Great Deal of Ingenuity, was released. Our guest is also a freelance writer for several Christian charities. She was recently invited to speak at an event called Poems, Prayers and Pints. But what was this all about? What does she think of all the Christian literature, including fiction? What is the premise behind Isabella M. Smooge? How difficult is the process to write not just one book, but a series on Isabella? How can she get TV companies and movies, etc. interested in her character? Does she want that? And why was her publicity photo taken with her kitchen as a backdrop? Is there a subliminal message that needs to be explored? And finally, why write a Jane Austen-type book? All these questions deserve answers, maybe, maybe not. Gives me great pleasure to welcome to the podcast today, and that's Ruth Lee. Ruth, thank you so much for joining us. I have no idea where this interview is going to go today because we've had such a great chat already. For those that know nothing about Ruth Lee, where are we speaking to you from, please?
Okay, so I am in the Palace of Creativity, which is my studio in a garden in a hamlet in East Suffolk. So I'm in the middle of lots of muddy fields. I'm sitting looking at my drafty Victorian house, you know, so yeah, but it's quite nice and warm in here. And thank you for having me, Martin, I should say. It's a real honour.
Oh, wow. You're very, very, and thrice very welcome. Thank you. I like the name Palace of, what was it?
Creativity. People talk about sheds or pods or cabins or home offices, and that is what they are. But that sounds quite dull. You know, saying I'll see you in the home office doesn't really have a ring.
No.
And when my husband and my middle son built the said cabin, I thought to myself as a, you know, lifelong sort of person who likes to take something boring and turn it into something fun, what can I call it? And palace, obviously it's not a palace, it's a log cabin, so I called it a palace. It's got to be the palace of something, the palace of creativity. And I kind of had this yearning, I suppose, one day in my life to say things like, if you need me, I'll be at my club, or ask the butler to ring for me, I'll probably be in a small summer parlour. So I haven't got there yet, haven't got to that place, but being able to say, I'll see you in the palace, just, you know, has a certain ring to it, I like to think.
It does. And keeps you humble as well, of course.
So humble.
Yeah.
So relatable. Two of my greatest qualities, Martin.
Well, I don't like to talk about my humility, so I won't.
No, we'll talk about that later for a couple of hours if we've got time.
Well, let's go for the five questions first of all. As I said, I've got no idea where this podcast is going to go, and it's going to be, I think it's going to be a cracker, so let's go for it. Question number one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be, please, Ruth?
No question, it's Jane Austen, every time.
Because?
In her 30s, I think. So she's still in pretty good health. Late 30s, maybe early 40s, probably her 30s. That's how old she would be when she popped round.
Yes. Well, obviously, with my time machine, I could bring her back to present day.
That'd be good.
Yeah. What would you like to talk to her about?
Oh, I would have such a good chat with her. I need to find out a lot of tea, as the youngsters say. So I need to find out what went on with her and her sister-in-law, Elizabeth Austen, who was married to Edward Austen, who was adopted by a rich couple. The word on the street was that she and Elizabeth didn't get on terribly well. So I'd like to find out a bit about that. I'd like to know what really went on with potential love interests, which have been, that's a myth that's been exploded in some recent scholarly works. Mm-hmm. I'd love to just have a good old chat about the characters in Pride and Prejudice. I'd like to find out how she intended to end her unfinished novel and just generally have a chat about literature, being a woman in a man's world, how she felt growing up. That kind of thing. Have a really long, wide-ranging chat. I would then offer her a bed for the night so we could carry on chatting the next day.
The meter would be running in my time machine to take her back, but I think I can let you go with that.
You've gone through all that trouble to get the time machine out and bring her back. I need to get my money's worth, really.
Well, obviously, if I'm having to wait, I want to know what food you're cooking her, because obviously I'd like a meal as well. So what would you cook, Jane?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I'd probably hand over cooking duties to my dear husband, who does nearly all the cooking in the household. I think looking back at Regency food, we'd probably start with a dish of tea just to chill her out a bit because she's obviously travelled forward quite a lot.
Yes.
This is wintertime, so I think a nice hearty soup, probably something like a watercress soup with homemade bread. Then I'm seeing fish, actually. I'm seeing a really nice piece of sea bass maybe with a sauce, some lovely home-cooked vegetables, and we finish off with a cheese board and coffee.
Sounds very good. I'm looking forward to My doggy bag being brought out, thank you.
There's a seat at the table for you, Martin. That's okay. You can just sit there and nod and smile. But you'll have to read up on her novel so that you can drop stuff into the conversation.
Yeah, trouble is, I must probably interfere too much and ask my kind of questions, you see, and then it would detract from you.
Maybe go and sit in the lounge in front of the telly with Mr. Lee and a cup of char. How about that?
Sold. Or maybe a beer.
Oh, yeah, a beer. Much better idea.
Thank you. Well, finally then, on the Jane Austen front, she died fairly young, but I don't know how she died. What do you know about that?
Oh, lots and lots. Yeah, she died in Winchester in her early 40s. And there's been lots and lots of talk of what it might have been. Some people say it was a liver problem. Some say Addison's disease. Others say it was a chronic stomach complaint. But I think it's generally believed now that, unfortunately, at that time in history, very early 19th century, they didn't understand a lot of conditions, as we don't now. And looking back on it, there are ways that she could have been absolutely fine, which makes it all the worse, because the Austens were a very long-lived family. They mostly lived well into their 80s and 90s, but sadly she became ill, was given certain medication that I don't think did her any good, and slipped away in her early 40s, which is a tragedy, because she'd written 6 amazing novels and would have carried on. And who knows where she would have gone? We just don't know.
Did she make any money at the time of her life?
Very little money, sadly.
Question 2 then, who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Ruth?
Oh, now then, there's quite a lot of answers to that. I could say Esther, that's a cracking book, or I could say Ruth, which is a good book, even though they named it after me. But I think it's not really a parable. Can I have Philip and the Eunuch, you know, the one where he's driving along and says, why shouldn't I be baptised right now, that one?
Yes, I will let you go for Philip and the Eunuch, but you said you're humble. The Book of Ruth isn't about you.
Really? Oh, maybe I should reread it then. Darn.
Yeah, I think you should.
Okay. So why do I like that story? I just like it because of the action in it. I'm a big fan of narrative being driven along at a pace. You know, I'm not a fan of sort of slow, wishy-washy stuff. And it's a great story. I like the fact that Philip is visited by an angel who gives him enormously clear instructions. You know, I like to put it in today's story. So rather than going straight up the A1 and turning left, he's told to go the back way. You know, don't do that. Thank you very much. Go on the B roads in your car. He doesn't say, well, why? That's ridiculous. It's all right then. Off he goes on the desert road, and along comes a chariot, top of the range. So we're looking at a Tesla, which I like, driven by a chauffeur. In the back is a very, very smart guy with a top of the range iPad or whatever, doing some reading. And he sees a smelly, dusty man trudging along. Why does he stop? Why does he shout to the charioteer, put the brakes on and roll down the window? I like that. Unlikely, but it's a good motif, isn't it?
Mm.
And then instead of just leaning out the window, I mean, I'm obviously saying it's a Tesla, but instead of just leaning out the chariot and saying, you smelly man, I've got a question for you, but can you stay quite a long way away because you are well below me socially and physically? He says, hop in. I like to think that he offers him a bottle of water, maybe a biscuit, a sandwich, perhaps some crisps. I don't know. Have they picked up a meal deal? We don't know. That's how I'd rewrite it, you see. Sits with him, and instead of just saying, look at me, I'm the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the Queen of the Ethiopians, he chats very humbly, asks a question, and this is key for me, listens to the answer. Take note, people who run countries and are Chancellors of the Exchequer these days. Listens to the answer, and then instead of going, oh, right, I'll think about that, thanks a lot, out you get, says, well, hang on a minute, there's some water over there, why shouldn't I be baptised right now? You know, it's so wonderfully immediate, and as a writer, I just love unpacking the detail, and I could probably write quite a long, short story just based on it. I love the fact it's got a beginning, a middle, an end, and then I love the way that it ends, where it says, Philip gets out, and the eunuch saw him no more. Where did he go? We don't know. I can only assume that God said, right, you've been really obedient. So rather than making you carry on down this B road, I will transport you by means at my disposal to where you're meant to go. I like that. This is sort of honouring him. So that is a very long, rambling exposition of why that's my favourite story.
Two things. Firstly, that is such a gift you've got of making it modern day. You have to do certain stories, please, in the Bible as your next book. Seriously.
Ooh, really?
Yeah. Modern day take on classic stories. Absolutely brilliant the way you portrayed it. Secondly, of course, there was I talking about my teletransporter machine to bring Jane Austen forward to meet you. But obviously, in the Bible, the first person to ever be using a teletransporter was Philip.
Of course he was, like that.
I'm not the first person to have picked this up. Teletransportation.
Mm.
Move over, Captain Kirk.
An actual thing.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Thank you. I look forward to your book when it comes out. I'll give you a couple of days.
Very good idea. Thank you.
Question 4. Oh, it's not, sorry.
No, it's not. Question 3.
Question 3.
Eyes down.
Thank you. If you're Prime Minister for the day, Ruth, and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Oh, these are stonking questions, Martin. And the thing is, I'll be completely honest, in the interest of transparency, and when this is played, when I am enormously famous but still humble and relatable, I'd like people to hear this back and think, oh, that's really good. You know, I can see she deserves success. Yeah. I remember you emailing me this question, me coming up with a cracking answer, which I now can't remember. So a lot's happened, actually, in the political landscape since we first spoke. You know, it would be something around homelessness or people on the margins. So someone who's struggling, so someone who's trying to access social services, perhaps, or a homeless person who through no fault of their own finds themselves on the streets, and some piece of legislation has been put there to make their life more difficult. I would sweep that away and I would put something in to say that can never, ever been reinstated. That's what I'd do.
Well, I think you might actually have some context, because it sounds as if your phone is telling you that somebody from the government's on the other end.
Yes. Oh, here he is again. Go away, Keir. I've told you. I'm talking to Martin.
Thank you.
I'll turn the volume down. I mean, I've told all my people. You know, I said to my people in the palace, just darling, keep people away. I'm talking to Martin.
Bless.
There we go. What's question four?
Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out, please?
Now then, that is another good one. Okay, actually, in recent living memory, and I don't have a lot of days out that aren't work-related, I went to Brighton in April. I went to stay with my lovely friend Deborah Jenkins, also a writer, check her out, folks, in Uckfield, which is in Sussex, because I was researching my next Jane Austen book, which is a follow-up to A Great Deal of Ingenuity, and I needed to go to Brighton to do some heavy old research on two of the stories, which are set in Regency Brighton. And I just had the most wonderful day. I was so happy. I was so in the moment, which is something I'm not usually. I'm very bad at living in the moment and just enjoying the moment. I'm always looking back or looking forward. I'm never off. And it was a perfect day. Blue skies. It was warm. It was beautiful. The sea was blue and sparkling. I just got a new phone because my very old one had broken. And I was taking pictures and looking at them thinking, blimey, Ruth, that looks really good. So I just had the most fun time. I had a lovely breakfast with Deborah, drove to Brighton, met this incredible chap, Dr. Geoffrey Mead, who is an expert on Regency Brighton, who spent 2 hours with me telling me stuff, because I'm such a massive nerd, stuff that made me very happy, pleased my nerdy brain. I had lunch in a pub that was a Regency pub. I spoke to lots of people. I took loads of photos. I made copious notes. I walked up and down streets and found the houses I was going to be writing about. And in my mind, peopled them with those characters. I mean, it's not a word I bandy around often, but it was a perfect day. I just loved it. Yeah. I was alone, but not lonely. I was solitary, yet with many other people in my mind. It was just the most enjoyable time. And I suppose I was walking about thanking God, saying, gosh, you've given me my heart's desire. It took a long, long time for me to become a fiction writer. I was 54 when it happened for me. That's, you know, knocking on a bit. And I never thought it would. And yet here I was, a real fully-fledged published writer, walking about doing a research trip, as I had seen other writers doing. And that will always live in my mind, I think.
Well, that's a great day out. You were alone, but not lonely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Question five, Ruth. On the other side of the coin, what has been your most embarrassing moment?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's two, and they're both child-related. The worst one, which will have parents cringing. I think we'll go for number two, actually, which isn't quite as terrible.
Oh, boo.
Go on then. All right, the first one, I was in Boots. Other chemists are available in Woodbridge with my little boys at the time. They're both grown up now, and I only had two children at the time. They were probably about two and four. And I was at the stage where you can't take your eye off them for a minute. So we were walking around, and I had a basket in my hand, and we were buying stuff. I don't know what, you know, pull-ups, knit shampoo, whatever you buy when you have young children. And the little one kept reaching down and holding things, then dropping them on the floor. And a lady appeared who was probably in her 50s, very athletic. She was carrying a squash racket. She was in squash clothes. She had very short crop grey hair. And she was clearly a delightful, charming woman. And she was just lovely. She kept picking stuff up and smiling indulgently at the children and saying, oh, and I was like, oh, thank you. So, oh, it's all right. Aren't they lovely? So I was feeling a warm glow of satisfaction as a mother. This lovely woman was being so kind and obviously thought my children were delightful. So my oldest had quite a penetrating voice, and this lady smiled one more time, started to walk away, but she hadn't got very far when my eldest said in a very, very loud voice, "Mummy, why does that man look like a lady?" We said, "Shh, but mummy, why does the man look like a lady?" Darling, why do you keep saying shush, mummy? I didn't know what to do. I had a big old bag of stuff to buy. I think I just walked out the shop because I was like, of all the people you could have chosen to inadvertently offend, I don't know how she felt about it, because I think I just scuttled out at top speed, cringing with embarrassment. So that was pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, that's brilliantly embarrassing. I take it she didn't actually hear.
I bet she did, though, because she wasn't very far away. And as I say, his voice was loud and clear. I had taught him to enunciate correctly, which he duly did.
I don't think you can better that, can you?
Oh, no, I can.
Go on, then.
Oh, yes, I can. Much worse. Much. Same child.
Yeah.
So at this point, I only had him. I was still living in Buckerstill in Essex. He was a delightful child. He slept beautifully. I was the envy of all the other mums. Didn't really go through the terrible twos. He was a delight. However, he would have been about, I don't know, 18 months maybe. And he went through a phase of throwing things. Anything you gave him, he would immediately throw. So I stopped going out for a bit. I stopped going out with the toddler girls. I stopped going out with my, you know, I didn't really have a social life. Because anywhere I went, he would grab things and throw them. He wasn't trying to be horrible. It was just a stage, but it was very embarrassing. So my mother-in-law, who lived just down the road, said, look, you haven't been out for such a long time. Why don't we go out for lunch? I said, I can't, because you'll throw stuff. She said, well, why don't we go to the carvery at the top of the road? So the carvery seemed like a good idea.
Yes.
Sticky carpet, very swirly, horrid, sort of brownie orange carpet. If you threw your dinner on it, no one would notice. You know, I'm not being rude about carveries. They're great, but they're not haute cuisine. You know, you don't have to sit there and behave particularly well, because it's a carvery. It's help yourself. And I thought, well, I'm not going to know anyone in there. What could possibly go wrong? I remember thinking to myself. And the answer actually came out, a lot could go wrong. So back then, he ate at top speed. And the only way I could eat simultaneously was to get everything he was going to eat on or around the high chair while I gobbled my own food. So he queued up. We got a little plate for him of this. He was a very good eater, and I got mine. I started eating at top speed. He was dropping peas everywhere. He was eating, but dropping most of it on the floor. I thought, doesn't matter. So the only way I could extend my eating time was to carry around lots and lots of little Petit Fiu yogurts. Other brands are available. So I had about six of these things with a plastic spoon. So I got the first one, peeled off the top, put it on his tray, and he started eating it, as you would. And all I did, and this is where I went wrong, I turned my head for a nanosecond to the left away from him because my mother-in-law had said something. And when I turned it back, to my horror, his arm was back. He had the Petit Fiu in his hand and he was about to throw it. And it was one of those no moments. He was a good thrower. So he threw it and it sailed across the room. So not great. It's going to get a lot worse. And I had vaguely noticed that quite a long way away at a table was a party of three. There was a lady wearing a very smart black outfit and two gentlemen. And she looked quite upset. There was obviously something going on. Just as he was throwing it, she stood up and it hit her square. This isn't the bad bit. This isn't the bad bit. It gets worse. Hit her square on this outfit and just yogurt exploded all over her. I was speechless. I didn't know what to do or say. So he just sat there sheepishly with his head down. He knew he'd done a very bad thing. And this woman rushed past me covered in yogurt in floods of tears to the toilet. So, of course, I was mortified. I mean, I just thought this is the worst thing that would ever happen to me. So I got up and went over to the two gentlemen at the table. I said, I am so sorry. You know, please let me pay for the cleaning. You know, I abased myself. And they were lovely. They said, no, please don't worry. I said, but this is terrible. My child has thrown yogurt at your friend. And this isn't even the bad bit. And they said, no, it's fine. Normally she'd laugh about it. But today is the anniversary of her son's death and we're just on our way to the cemetery. I was like, oh, good Lord. So I was like, oh, no. So she came out and I just went over and I said, I just apologised and apologised and apologised. And she was crying because, of course, she was really sad.
Yeah.
I can't remember what I did. I think I just pressed the tenner into her hand and left. I remember thinking to myself, I'll never top that. And even the boot thing was never that bad. That was the worst. And I sometimes say to him now, you know, he's a tall, handsome 21-year-old with quite a good throw, actually. And I occasionally mention it. And I say, I've never, ever had anything more embarrassing happen to me than that. So well done. There you go.
If there are any screenwriters out there listening to this, that has to go in a film, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though?
With a bit going, no, in slow motion, not that.
You could have a slow motion no bit.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that. What I've already learned so far is that you're 54 years of age a few years ago.
Yes.
A couple of months ago, let's be polite about it.
Very good. A couple of months ago, thank you.
So before going into writing then, what did you used to do for a living?
I have done many, 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 many things. I have sold double glazing in my extreme youth, would you believe? Also central heating quite successfully. I worked on a magazine in Devon Life, where I sold advertising for 3 years. I ran a French restaurant. I worked at the University of Exeter, which I loved. That was a great job. Then I got married, moved to Essex, worked for UCL at the Department of Psychology for the head of department, which I also loved.
UCL being?
University College London.
Thank you.
At the same time, I was doing my English degree next door at Birkbeck, which is another part of the University of London. I left there and I went to work for a law firm, worked for a partner in a trademark and patents firm in London. Along the way, I started a catering business. I used to do a bit of freelance writing. So I was doing lots of things. And then my freelance writing career started in 2008 when I was expecting baby number three, who turned out to be a girl. And that was my career for a long time. It was freelance and it was mostly from home. And I built up a portfolio, which sounds a very posh way of saying it, but it was a portfolio. It is mostly Christian charities, although I get secular work as well. And that was great. And that was getting busier, which was good as the children were growing. I loved it. And what was really good about it is that if you're a freelancer, you have to be really disciplined. So I often say this when I'm speaking, when I'm giving talks, that often someone who wants to write fiction will say things like, oh, you know, I have to have my lucky pen, or I cannot possibly write until the muse has alighted. Well, I've got no time for that. If a freelance client emails you, as mine frequently do, and says, right, the next magazine's coming up, you've got 3 weeks, here's some emails, email these people, write me an article, this is what I want, this is how much I'm going to pay you. You cannot reply by saying, well, if the muse alights upon the pause, produce something, but if not, I cannot possibly. Yeah, yeah, all right. And you do it. It's a very disciplined way of, and I learn all about word counts, high-res images, how you get really great quotes out of someone who doesn't want to meet you or has things, says things like, oh, I've got nothing to say.
Yeah.
You still have to get the piece. You have to get something. So that was going great. And then in February 2020, I was sitting in my dining room. This was pre-Palace days. Feeling quite smug, not an emotion I feel very often. And I remember saying to myself, gosh, Ruth, you are doing well. Look at all these new clients coming in. Because finally, the word got out in the Christian charity sector that I was a safe pair of hands. You know, soon you'll have to start a waiting list. Things are going great. You might actually start to make some decent money from this. So the next month, of course, lockdown hit. And probably 75% of my clients said, look, really sorry, but, you know, we're furloughing everybody. We can't afford to pay you. See you on the other side. So I was like, oh, okay. So there I was with maybe two or three clients left, you know, which was good, but I had a lot of time on my hands. So very fortunately for me, I was writing for the Association of Christian Writers, More Than Writers blog. I just started doing it in the October. And the thing about freelance is there's no room for jokes in it. You know, it's not the place to make gags. And I am quite a funny woman. I like making people laugh, as we have testified with the story of Philip and his Tesla. Well, the Unix Tesla, and there's nowhere for that. I always say to people, I'd read all my life, watched funny stuff, and it was all in my head, but there was nowhere for it to go. So when they said, look, we'd like you to take over the slot on the 7th for these blogs, I was like, oh, hang on a minute. That means I can write whatever I want within reason. So I became known as the funny one. I would write funny stuff and make jokes. And when you're a blogger, all you want is for people A, to read it, and B, to comment on it. And they were. And these were other writers saying, oh, that's really funny. I was like, oh, okay. So I carried on doing that. And when it came to April 2020, I was sitting in my dining room, dust everywhere, roots showing through, nettles in the garden, three children upstairs not doing their online homework. So I wasn't, you know, living that lockdown dream at all. And this slot was coming up. And I thought, right, now what am I going to write this month? Because I'd done a few funny ones and I'd done a couple of serious ones. I thought, right, I know, I'm just going to do something that is just for laughs. There's no, you know, literary merit to it. No one will learn anything from it. I just wanted to make the other writers laugh hysterically because I had been annoyed a lot recently by these people online, many of them women, who were baking banana bread, living their best lives, finding themselves, loving lockdown because it was giving them opportunities to hashtag make memories, all that kind of malarkey. And I was just sick to death of it. I was like, oh, for goodness sake, will you shut up already? You know, most of us are just staggering along moment to moment, letting the bananas go moldy, you know, all that stuff, not doing Joe Wicks. So I thought, right, who would be the opposite of me? A rich, posh, skinny woman. So I made her up, Isabella M. Smoosh, because it spells out I am smug.
Oh.
That was the joke. That's why. Because I knew the joke, because I love a pun. I thought, calling a woman I am smug. And then I thought, Isabella, that's great. M, am, smug. So I looked at these words that I'd scribbled on the back of an envelope. And I thought, I can't call her smug. I need to make it funnier. So I added the G and the E as in Bruges, Smooge as in Bruges, which of course is terribly pretentious. That's why she's called that. So I wrote this thing called The Utter Joy of One's Craft. It was terribly pretentious. It was her banging on about how perfect her life was for the first three paragraphs. And then I reverted to my own voice explaining what my life was like. So obviously we had that whole dichotomy, you know, and people really liked it. I had some really good comments and I was really chuffed. And lots of people kept saying, why don't you write a novel about Isabella M. Smoot? And I just said, nah, don't be silly. I don't write fiction. Next month, I wrote a really serious piece on women's mental health and how we constantly compare ourselves to other women online and how that had been intensified by the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I chucked in Isabella M. Smoot. I thought it was just the sort of thing she would do. You know, oh, darling, buy my eye cream and everything will be marvellous. So on the 7th of May, 2020, I was in the Polytunnel with my husband and my phone was beeping away like mad because everyone was commenting on the blog, which was great. And then I got a message in the afternoon from Tony Collins, who I didn't realise was a doyen of Christian publishing, who had just decided to become a literary agent. I know, I didn't know any of this. And he said, I agree with everyone, Ruth. I think this would make a great novel. Why don't you write me a couple of chapters and a story arc, send it over, and I'll pitch stuff around for you for free. Did I mention I've just become a literary agent? Believe me, this is the kind of thing that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It fell from the skies. And I didn't even know what a story arc was. Tony, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry I never told you this. I actually went and Googled, what is a story arc? And then I found it. I was right, okay, I'll do one of them then. So I went over to the house. Mr. Lee made a cup of tea and said, get writing. Opened my laptop, started typing. And within 24 hours, I'd written the first two chapters of the diary of Isabella M. Smoot. Now, I always say this, it's terribly important. It's very easy as an author to come across all sort of pretentious. Oh, yes, you know, it was so easy for me. I wrote 6 books in 2 weeks. No. Yes, I wrote it quickly, but that's because it was ready to come out.
Yeah, yeah.
All that stuff had been in my head for donkey's years, for decades, and someone had finally given me permission to write it down. So I did. So I wrote the first book, and there it is. Isabella has been launched into the world. She's pretentious. She's an influencer. She goes around showing off, making a great deal of money out of it. She was the first person to realize you can show off online and make a very good living. She's rich, privileged. She's from aristocratic stock, happily married to a banker, 3 children, lots of staff, gorgeous house in the country because she moves to Suffolk at the beginning of the first book. But of course, then everything goes peak Tom, as it would. So giving me a chance to be funny, but I very quickly realized I can't write a novel about a one-dimensional character I made up for a blog. She has to be a fully fleshed out person,
yeah.
Which she very quickly became. So there we are.
Well, thank you for that, because what I want to do now is put the other side of the story, if that's okay, the true Ruth. When did you become a Christian, first of all?
26.
When you were 26, or yeah, the year 2026, which we haven't got to yet?
When I was 26, a couple of weeks ago. Well, that's my machine. Let's say 10 years ago. Should we say that? I mean, that's not true, but we can say it.
It's not true. Well, we can just imagine, can't we?
Shall we?
Yeah, in your mid-20s, let's say. But the thing is that when you gave us a quick CV of your work history, what came to mind for me immediately was, this is brilliant, because for those that are listening today, especially, and maybe they're feeling at a crossroads or hadn't even thought they were at a crossroads, God will, I think, look at what you've done in the past 20-odd years to say, well, look, that person, they might have really suffered in loads of areas, but look at that training that they've been instilling without realizing it. Let's bring it out to the open. Mm. And here you are, 54 and beyond.
Yeah, I know.
Able to use all your knowledge. From a Christian point of view, what do you want to use in your books?
Excellent questions, Martin. Very thought-provoking, and you make a very good point.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that I always say is that life is copy. You know, it's super easy to put a gloss on everything and put a mask on, and that doesn't do anyone any good. It doesn't serve me well, and it doesn't serve anyone else well either.
Mm.
So very quickly, when I started writing Isabella, I knew that she was going to be like the majority of the British population, I would say. Someone who thinks there's probably some kind of a deity up there, who will go to church at Christmas, perhaps Easter. If someone gets married in a church, they're there. Doesn't pray unless they're really in, you know, quite difficult circumstances, and has a vague suspicion that if you're good, probably stuff will be okay.
Yeah.
So I knew, because this really matters to me, I spent a lot of my Christian life evangelizing, pastoring people, talking to people who would never dream of walking into a church.
Yeah.
One of the things, one of my pet hates is big, waggy, preachy fingers telling people off. I can't bear that. It really annoys me. And people forgetting that once upon a time, perhaps they too were standing outside a pair of doors thinking, I'm a bit scared. What will I find if I walk through these doors?
Yeah.
Really easy, I think, to, you know, get so used to church subculture that you don't think what it's like for someone who might want to find out what it's all about. So Isabella is that person. There she is on the playground on the first day of term. She stands out for all the wrong reasons, terribly glamorous, rich, wearing the wrong clothes. She's got no pair with her. Everyone's a bit baffled. So I knew I had to have an in. So up comes the vicar's wife, who Isabella has already judged quite harshly. She's overweight. She really should do something about her hair. Is she pregnant or does she have shockingly lax abdominal muscles? Terrible snob. And, you know, she could really benefit from a chemical peel. So that's her first thoughts on seeing this woman.
Yeah.
And she's the vicar's wife. Chat, chat, chat. She's really nice to her. They've got children in the same year and they have coffee. And quite quickly, Isabella's expectations are confounded. She assumes this is a mumsy, jam and Jerusalem kind of woman who's always been a Christian and does whatever Christians do, playing the guitar, wearing a lot of beige, eating quiche, all that stuff. But no, she's not. She is a recovering addict, an alcoholic, who was fostered as a child because she was taken out of a very dangerous domestic abuse situation. And just because she became a Christian doesn't mean that all got fixed, because it didn't. She's scarred and she carries that burden every day. So that was my in. And through that, I think I've been able to certainly be funny about church subculture. I'm not laughing at the church at any point, but I'm making jokes that have always struck me. You know, as a lifelong Baptist, when God sent me off to be in the CV for a while, it threw me a bit. I was like, what are they talking about? What do you mean PCC? What's that?
Yeah.
Church meetings only last 10 minutes when the Baptists can have it all night. You know, that kind of stuff. And I thought it's funny because many of my readers aren't believers particularly, or they don't go to church, but they still love it because it's about a woman who doesn't know who she is, who is meeting real authentic people who are offering her real friendship. So that's the sort of message, I think. And the other thing, which I always say, and it's super important, I am so not a fan of the kind of prevalent Christian fiction where something happens, you read the story and you chug along and it's all going on. And in the penultimate chapter, everyone becomes a Christian, because that's not what happens. I have no interest in making up an alternative universe where this happens. It's all about taking two steps forward and one step back, failure, doubting yourself, thinking, really, I'm not good enough to go into that place, meeting people and things happening and all that sort of stuff. So Isabella doesn't start going to church and find a radiant holiness in the penultimate chapter. Far from it. It's a slow, slow up and down journey, as it is for many of us, I think. It's funny. I mean, they're very funny books, but at the heart of them is something that seems to really touch my readers of all faiths and none, which I found really interesting. And I'm not even quite sure myself what that is. People will often say to me, your books really help me, Ruth. There's one lady in particular who has quite a hard life, and she says that when times are really tough for her, she takes all four of the books and she goes upstairs and she lies on her bed and she reads them one after another, and it helps her. In the first book, there's a little bit of churchy stuff, not very much. In the second book, a little bit more. In the third book, a little bit more. But because Isabella is changing a tiny bit, because we don't change that much in our lives, it's believable. And lots of people have been genuinely interested to read about stuff that isn't out there in the mainstream. I am going to stop talking in a minute. What a long answer to a question. But I think the thing that really struck me the most, one of my friends, lovely woman, who's a huge Isabella fan, she read book two and we had lunch. She's somebody who's interested in lots of different expressions of faith. And I said, so how did you feel about all that stuff about forgiveness and praying? She went, oh, Ruth, I love that stuff. It was really good. I was like, really? She went, oh, yeah, I love all that stuff. Like, okay. Because I'm writing it for someone who doesn't go to church particularly, that's who's in my mind.
Yeah.
I never want them to be reading it and be lost with weird sort of church talk, because that's no good to anybody. Isabella is frequently baffled herself by it all. She joins a home group and naturally she wants to know what kind of biscuit you should serve. Do you make those noises? Yes, Lord, yes, Lord, when other people are praying, or is that rude? You know, how do you know when it's your turn, if everyone's got their eyes shut? All that stuff, because she's coming in from the outside. I don't think, I mean, I'm sure as soon as this goes out, someone will come on the comments saying, I do that. I haven't found anyone else doing that in that world. So it's quite nice to be doing something new, I think.
Well, that's very good. What I'd like to ask you, and go a bit further, if that's okay, my humour, or lack of it, or whatever you want to call it, I think certainly the early days of my Christian walk has got me into trouble.
Mine too.
So yeah. Let's talk about your side, if that's okay. Especially also, and we can throw this in, is that certainly 10, 20 years ago in America, if you wanted to crack the American scene, your penultimate chapter would have to be that the whole world was saved.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll never touch the American market. Hopefully it's changed now.
A bit.
How important is humour to you, and how much has it got you into trouble in the past?
Oh, well, massively is the answer to the first question. Hugely important. Humour is something wonderful. It transforms life. You know, it makes laughing is so good for you. And I suppose my way of dealing with difficult situations, and believe me, there are plenty of those in my life, often is to laugh at them. You know, to quote the great woman herself in Pride and Prejudice, Lizzie Bennet laughs at things to forget how ruinously depressing they are, stuck in a house with a mother who is trying to marry her off and a father who has abdicated all responsibility. That's quite depressing. So she makes a lot of jokes. Has it got me into trouble? Yeah, not trouble exactly, but I am rather prone to making jokes. And then when someone doesn't get it and ask for it to be explained, I make it worse. So this isn't particularly relevant possibly, but when I first came to Suffolk and the good Lord in his infinite wisdom, instead of sending me to a perfectly good Baptist church where I would have been much more comfortable, decided to put me into the C of E. One of the things that happened was quite early on, they started showing pictures of this house on the overhead in the notices and say, oh, do let us know if you're coming to Sizewell. And I was like, sorry, Sizewell as in the nuclear
reactor? Sizewell B.
Yeah, Sizewell B, our local friendly neighbourhood nuclear reactor, which is just down the road. And so I very quickly realised that, in fact, someone had built a very lovely house on the cliff, which is a Christian retreat centre, before the dome and the reactor and everything. But me being me, I found this hilarious. So I would say to people, oh, so I suppose, you know, when you come back, you've got a real glow about you. And they'd look at me, or I'd say things like, you know, it's just radiating holiness. And they'd look at me blankly. I'd go, because it's a nuclear reaction. They go, what? You know. So this happened a lot. And no one thought it was funny apart from me, as I recall. But I kept on going in the hope that one of these days someone would laugh. But I don't think anyone ever did. So sometimes I make a joke in a churchy environment. And if I get a blank look these days, I just go, oh, okay. So you don't think that's funny. I'll just talk about something else.
But it's interesting. You're talking about the vicar's wife and that she was abused. Obviously, there's research that you can fall back on from your past life as well, from outside your own life. But how much of the abuse is actually from within yourself that you've had to suffer?
Oh, now, no one has ever asked me that question before. That's a genuinely thought-provoking question, Martin. I suppose quite a lot then, actually. I haven't suffered what Claire did. I didn't see domestic abuse around me, no. Mm-hmm. I would say certainly the reaction to emotional abuse and not having your needs met, your basic needs met as a child, is to go in on yourself, which I certainly did do, to find solace in books, to the extent that I'm a pathological reader. I mean, left to myself, I'd read 20 books a week. There's nothing I would rather do. Yes, trying to make jokes because trying to make something funny helps you to forget how painful it is. Yes, definitely.
Yes.
And deflecting. I am a past master at deflecting because I have been so used, sadly, on having, yeah, too much responsibility put on me from a very young age, painful things happening. So Isabella deflects. She's brilliant at it. She's made a career from it. That's me to a certain extent. Well, to a massive extent. And some of the characters who are damaged from difficult childhoods don't acknowledge that. They find ways to get through life, which perhaps might lead to difficult things for themselves, to them presenting in a certain way. So one of the characters I write, who I think is probably my favourite character to write and certainly comes up a lot in dispatches when people are talking about Isabella, is Isabella's frenemy on the playground, Leanne Bloomfield, who is this terrifying playground mum. She's from a family who's always been in the village. She's never left. She never will leave. Split up from her partner, who's useless, 5 children, bringing them up as a single mother, working very hard, hard as nails. And I really like the way she's got no filter. She says whatever comes into her head. She says, calls Isabella smug. Always smug. With someone like that, she's not going to just crack and reveal all this terrible stuff that happened to her. And I just like very delicately alluding very occasionally. Because if she tells you something personal, for her, that's huge.
Mm.
And that's authentic. And in book 4, there's 2 characters, herself included. The other one is not a sympathetic or a kind or a nice character. But I wrote this scene, which actually made my husband cry when he read it. He reads all my stuff first. And he came in, he said, oh my goodness, that's the saddest thing I've ever read. But it had to be in book 4.
Yes.
Because in book 1 and 2, she's just an out-and-out villain. She's horrible. She makes Isabella's life awful. Not Leanne, someone else. She's a tabloid journalist. But then in book 3, we see a chink. And in book 4, I sat here in the palace and wrote it. And it didn't affect me because I'd already felt the emotions. It wasn't my story, but there were certainly elements of it. But other people, I read it out at the British Christian Writers Conference, which I co-run with Andy Chamberlain in Cambridge every year. and I was reading out a passage or two from Further Adventures, which was the latest one. And there was a lady at the back sobbing as I read out this story. And she came up to me and said, "That is absolutely heartbreaking." And the thing is, as a teacher, I've seen it happen to too many children. So I always say, you know, if you're writing funny, which I am, you can't just keep on being funny. Mm-hmm. It has to be funny, sad, light, shade, up, down. It has to be that. And people really respond to that. You know, I'm not writing some sort of misery memoir. There's a place in that, in the world for that genre. That's not it. But people are going to be much more touched by elements, I suppose, that have come from things I wish hadn't happened if I surround them with well-rounded characters who are funny and authentic.
You only have to take Blackadder the Fourth, which is just 4 to 6 episodes of amazing humour. But everybody remembers the last 2 minutes of the whole series.
Brilliantly sustained writing, yeah.
Because it's all about death.
Yes.
And then going over the trenches. And if you've never seen it, it's on YouTube. Have a look.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah.
If that's all right, can we go deeper, please? And if you don't want me to go deeper, then that's fine. I'm just thinking of those people out there that can identify with abuse and looking up to somebody. This could be the time whereby they can say, wow, I get, Ruth, what you're saying. What kind of abuse did you feel you had that made you then withdraw into yourself and read?
Well, abuse is a strong term to describe my childhood. My parents loved me. They loved each other. They went to church every week. They were Christians. They are Christians. One of them is still alive. But this was in the 60s, and they were both carrying a lot of pain and baggage and trauma from their past lives. And back then, it didn't seem to occur to people. And I'm not apportioning blame.
No.
It didn't occur to people, I think, to think, do you know what? Before we start a family, I think we'll just look at some of the stuff we're carrying and see if we can just deal with that first. I didn't have children deliberately for the first 10 years of my marriage, because I couldn't take the risk of bringing a child into the world and accidentally messing stuff up for them, like my parents accidentally messed stuff up for me. They meant so well. We had a warm, comfortable house. We were well fed. We were clothed. We went to church, all of that stuff. But they struggled. My father was autistic at a time when that wasn't understood. I only worked out, a friend of mine worked it out years later. And then everything fell into place. I was like, oh, okay. Of course, that's why he behaved that way. Mm. He was a kind, generous, loving man. He loved me. He wanted to do his very best for me as a father. But the trouble was, because he couldn't regulate himself, and of course there was no support, he was working really hard, you know, in his job to support us all. Mm-hmm. And when he came home, there wasn't much left over. And I understand that. And things overwhelmed him. There were certain tics. There were all kinds of things. But to a young child, that's frightening. You never knew when you were going to be shouted at or hit, both of them. And because I didn't really know how to cope with a little child, that was tough. Then my sister came along and I had to be responsible for her, really. And I'd spent all my time protecting her. Not because they were abusing us. They weren't. It was just, I suppose you'd call it, I don't know what you'd call it. You know, on the outside, it looked great. You know, middle class, sitting around a table, lots of homemade food. That was all lovely. But there were so many rules and regulations. And it didn't matter what I did, I could never get it right. I was always seemed to be doing something wrong by mistake. So I was always being punished and smacked and sent to my room. And there was a lot of guilt and shame. And again, I don't blame them for it. You know, they did the best with what they had, but it wasn't great. And then friends weren't particularly encouraged because that was too much trouble to have people around the house. So we didn't have friends. We didn't have a television. We did have a couple, but not many. So I just read all the time, all the time. I retreated into books. And primary school was okay because I knew everybody. I was in my village where, you know, everyone knew us, and I was really good at writing and spelling, and that was my thing. But the minute I passed the 11 plus and went to the local girls' grammar school, that was it for me. It was horrendous. You know, I would not go so far as to describe it as hell. Maybe I would. It was hellish. And I had a big red flag on my head that said, I'm really vulnerable. Why don't you bully me and coerce me? And when I go into high schools now and I give talks, I give inspirational workshops to the kids because I just love talking to teenagers, they're my favourite people. I always tell them the same stuff. I'm really honest. I talk about my own mental health. I talk about how dreadful school was for me and what happened. And I say that back then, coercive control hadn't been invented. But that's what happened to me. I was being coercively controlled by somebody very successfully. And that blighted my life. It really did. And my parents just didn't understand. Everything was my fault. So I couldn't say that, I couldn't tell them the truth because I only had this one friend. Everyone else thought I was a weirdo because I was. You know, I didn't know anything about popular culture. I didn't dress right. My hair was wrong. Everything was wrong about me. So that was not good at all. I ran away from home at 18, went off and started again in Exeter. And I hadn't realised that you can run away from stuff, but it stays with you, comes with you. When I'm giving talks about what happens to Isabella, I always say what happened to me. I don't say it was me, but it is that you can push it down, you can deflect, you can come up with any number of strategies for dealing with this stuff that won't go away. But one day you wake up and there it is. And that's what happens to Isabella. She deflects and deflects and deflects. And one day she wakes up and she's like, oh, hang on a minute, things are not going well for me. So that, I suppose, in essence, is it. I wasn't beaten up. I wasn't deprived of food. I wasn't sexually abused. I don't think, I can't remember, but not by my parents anyway, certainly not. But stuff happened. I know that I can't remember, and there's still stuff to work through. But yeah, that was it in essence.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you love talking to teenagers, and yet your teenage years were really, really bad from what you've been sharing so far. What do you mean by, without naming the person concerned, what do you mean by coercive control in your case?
These days, I've been a governor, a safeguarding governor, so I know the terms. These days, it's called peer-on-peer abuse. It's when somebody in your group, your year generally, or in your school, takes you over, I suppose. This person ran me. They started off small, you know, breaking up friendships I had developed, turning people against me, making me believe that this person was the only person who would ever understand me, that would have been my friend, telling me things like, oh, well, you know, you're not a very attractive girl, Ruth. You know, you'll probably struggle to find someone to love you and marry you, which, of course, I still believe, really, at the bottom of it all. I do believe that, genuinely. A lot of the lies I was told about myself, I believed, of course I did. And because I had no self-confidence and I didn't have those secure attachments, as we say in the trade, you know, from my parents, I was easy prey. So, yeah, she just took me over, used me for her own ends. It was awful, really bad. Left me with some bad stuff, I can tell you.
So what did you do about the bad stuff eventually? All these years later, what have you done about it?
Well, I didn't do anything about it, obviously, for many a long year. And then I got married and I left Exeter. And I'd been with my fiancé, boyfriend, who I'd met at school for 8 years. And I'd been in Exeter while he was in Buckhurst Hill. So our entire relationship had been conducted over a long distance. And this was in a time before mobile phones. We wanted to talk, we had to put 10p into the phone box and have a chat.
Yeah.
As you know, it was a different time. And it was either going to break us up or make us really strong, and it did number two. So when I got married to this lovely man and came and lived in Buckhurst Hill, everyone said, oh my goodness, Ruth, you must be so happy. You're finally with him. And I said, yes, yes, yes. But I couldn't understand why I was so, well, depressed. I was depressed. I'd come back, I suppose, to Essex. I'd left Exeter, which I loved. I'd left a job, which I simply loved. I'd left all my friends. And I'd started again, back in the place I swore I'd never come back to, which I suppose you could say, if you want to come over all psychologically, there was some trauma going on. I was revisiting a place and I had seen my parents a lot. You know, we kind of made peace, I suppose, but nothing had ever been resolved. I just carried on having these cycles where I'd be up all night crying, hating myself, saying, what's the matter with you? You're happily married. You've got a good job. Why can't you be happy? And then one day I fell apart at work and I thought, well, I can't go on like this. But I couldn't understand what was causing it. So I went to two really good friends at church and said, look, I know nothing can ever change for me. I know you can't do anything, but this is how I'm feeling. You know, can we perhaps pray? And at this point, you know, I was a Christian, but I suppose I was still fairly entry level. You know, people would talk about the spirit and I go, all right, lovely. But I was a bit, wasn't really sure what that meant, really. I was getting there. And they said, yeah, sure. So I went over to theirs for coffee and we sat down and we started praying. It was my first experience of people sitting there, giving up their evening for me, this worthless person. And apparently hearing directly from God. You know, this is not something, I mean, obviously I've done lots of praying, I'd heard lots of praying, but I'd never heard that kind. And I was a bit taken aback by it. I was like, oh. And they started saying things. It was stuff they couldn't possibly have known about me. So I was like, oh, interesting. So I thought to myself, well, I'm a very complex woman. Obviously, my psyche is very complex and deep. This will take probably years of intense intercession to fix. But God had other ideas. It took 3 sessions, in fact, to take, you know, I remember the feeling of it being lifted off my shoulders, the depression being lifted. Now, that didn't mean that everything was suddenly great, but it did mean that I'd been healed of depression, which then meant I was able to go home to my husband and say, right, I no longer have depression. Do you fancy starting a family? Not quite in those words, but you know. So then I had my first child. And as a result of that, we moved to Suffolk and lots of stuff happened. So yes, I did that, which was the key thing that started off the life I have now. Then again, in about, I think, 2017 or so, everything, a lot of stuff happened. And my life has never been easy. There's still lots of things going on. And I, again, had to reach out, and 2 friends of mine put me in touch with a counsellor who is amazing. And I think without him, I would never have become a fiction writer. Not Christian counsellor, just an incredibly gifted man.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of work with him. And I've learned a lot, you know, I've learned a huge amount. I research stuff all the time for work and for my own self. And I think working in psychology for as long as I did, I learned a huge amount about how we do work, lots of ways, models of looking at human behaviour. So I'm somebody who, I'm a really sort of rabid self-improver, always trying to be better. I'm always trying to improve myself. And that has its downsides too. You know, I'm never content with myself. I never sit back and take a moment to reflect. I'm very bad at that. But I suppose that does mean that I've written and published 6 books in 4 years. I'm not like the other girls, as I often say.
Thank you for sharing that. What comes across from my point of view is that you went to see people to be prayed for. God used those people so that you could find out what was the truth. You came back to your husband and said, look, the depression's lifted. But as we've often said so much in the past, especially when I've had Peter Mockford, who's an amazing Christian guy who's been very influential in my life and now one of the leading psychotherapists in the land, there's still a lot more that can be done. You now, because mental health is such a big thing, going to see what you would have said in the 70s or 80s, a shrink, you know, you would have been ostracized for, but not now. And that counsellor, doesn't matter if he's a Christian, he's not, but he knows how to help you out. And I think what I'd like to say for those that are feeling this and really hearing this, don't be afraid to cry out for help and go and see somebody in the medical profession. Start off with your own GP, first of all. The NHS still, believe it or not, will refer you. Looking back on it now then, just to sum it all up, your mental health and where you are now, what would you say?
I say at the time, I would have done anything for it to be over and not happening. But everything I went through and everything I continue to go through is used. You know, when I meet someone now who has been suffering from or is suffering from depression, I can say, I know exactly how you feel because I do. Not a phrase I'd use about things I haven't gone through. You know, talking to somebody who has been through what you are currently going through is a gift. I try to listen more than I talk. Mm-hmm. Time and time again, I meet people who are struggling or suffering and I'm able to empathise, and I wouldn't be able to if I'd had a lovely, easy life where everything was gorgeous and shiny.
Well, in the remaining few minutes, let's just bring it up to date. And I did mention at the front end about this thing called poems, prayers and pints.
Oh, yes.
And as soon as I saw that, I thought, now you're talking my language. What was it all about, please? How did it come about?
Okay, so one of the things I do that a lot of other people don't do, I go on the circuit. So every weekend, pretty much, I'm at an event selling my book. So I get to meet a lot of people. And I was at one of my favourite ones up in the north of the county at a very small village, which is brilliant. And all of a sudden, this guy walked in dressed as a vicar, who actually was the vicar. He wasn't just dressed as one. Youngish guy, looked a bit like a surfer, came wandering over. And he said, oh, hello, I'm the vicar. I said, oh, hello. Chat, chat, chat. And he said, look, I'm thinking about getting some writers together and doing a kind of outreach, you know, because I want more people on the PCC. I said, okay, happy to be up with that. So I got a load of people together. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, but I thought poems, pints and prayer, yeah, that's three nice things. And of course, three P's, you know, being a CV vicar, he would obviously have alliterated. That's what they do, I understand. So turned up at the pub, which is a great pub in the village, great big marquee outside, and just a completely random selection of people, some believers, some not, most of whom I knew, most of whom I brought along from other writing groups. And several of us stood up and read our stuff. The vicar stood up and read some quite heavy religious stuff, which I wasn't expecting, but people seemed fine about it, which I was very surprised about. And having run lots and lots of community events myself over the years, it had all the right ingredients. You know, people were sitting there nursing a pint or a vodka and orange and feeling completely chilled about that. People were standing up at the front and sharing beautiful, powerful words. There was a sense that it was a safe space where you could be heard. And sadly, there are less and less of those places as our society progresses, it seems to me. And it was great. It didn't achieve, I don't think, what he wanted it to achieve, which was lots of people leaping up at the end and saying, I'd love to join the PCC, because they didn't know what that was. And I think it should certainly carry on if they want to do it, and I'd be happy to be part of it. But it was one of those nights you look back on, you know, a summer's night in the middle of Suffolk, under a marquee, with just the sound of pints clinking in the pub and people laughing and dogs barking, and somebody standing up and reading out beautiful, powerful words. It was a lovely thing.
Brilliant. So where is Ruth Lee going to be going from a literary point of view, first of all, in the next few months and years ahead, do you think?
Well, you couldn't have asked me at a better time. Where she'd like to go, you know, obviously we don't believe in magic, but if I had some sort of magic wand that I could wave, what would happen? I would finish all my freelance work. I've got a lot of it at the moment, and I would be able to carry on with my Jane Austen novel follow-ups, finish that. That would be finished. I would pitch to agents, which I am going to be doing because my agent's retired. I'd be taken up by one of them. Curtis Brown would be lovely. If you're listening, Curtis Brown, thank you very much. they would then get me a deal with the BBC or Netflix to serialise my Jane Austen novels. I would then become a household name, but in a lovely way. You know, I'd be the kind of, I wouldn't be a celebrity. I'd just be a person that people ran into and I'd enrich their lives, like Marion Keyes, like a sort of middle-aged menopausal Marion Keyes kind of thing.
Don't know who she is, never heard of her.
Yeah, okay, she's brilliant. So from an entirely materialistic point of view, and I'm not a materialistic kind of girl, I'd be writing more books and they'd be reaching out to more people. But I think what I really want, although I do want what I just said, I really do, I'd love it if Isabella could go even further. She's already all over the world. She's already got a great big fan base and she's already really helping people and she's amusing them. She's making them think, she's making them laugh, she's making them cry. And I think her story is making people think, oh, okay, so maybe church isn't quite what I thought it was. Maybe it isn't full of weirdos playing the guitar and wearing socks and sandals. Maybe you can be yourself there. Maybe I could go there with all my scars and wounds and not be judged. That would be nice. That's what I'd like, I think. What will happen next? I will finish my Jane Austen book. So A Great Deal of Ingenuity 2, My Own Darling Child, it will be called. I think I might write that book about biblical stories. That sounds like fun. I might do that.
A modern day take, you mean?
Yeah, where you take like Philip and his Tesla and turn it into a story. That'd be quite good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, very good.
I think so. And more Isabella 5, that's marinating in my head. And maybe some other stuff. I don't know what else will come up. That would look pretty good to me if all that happened, I think.
Well, it sounds brilliant. Before we get to the final question, which of course is, you know, who your Christian hero is. In light of what you shared today, and I thank you so much for your honesty, and I did say right at the front end, I didn't know where it was going to go, and I didn't. But I also did say, God can take, you know, your past 20, 30 years of experience that you might not think is any good and use it for his good.
Mm.
What do you think God is saying to you today about what you've done so far and where he wants to take you? And where are you before God at the moment?
It's a funny old thing, isn't it? Went to bed last night, lay awake till 4:30, could not sleep. And I was just gripped with fear. This is a really interesting interview because you're getting non-funny Ruth. You're getting real Ruth, aren't you? And I'm being really honest here.
You are, it's great.
No, because I mean, I would never be dishonest, but I'm very good at skimming, you know, over the surface when I'm comfortable. So if someone's listening to this and needs to hear it, then I'm glad. So couldn't sleep, gripped with fear, worrying about the future, worrying about money, worrying about the children, beating myself about all the mistakes I've ever made. You know, those nights. And I woke up this morning feeling appalling, looking appalling. I mean, you can see me. I'm not looking at my most glamorous, but luckily your listeners can't see me. I've got lippy on, I brushed my hair, but really feeling like a pile of old poo, I'll be honest with you. And kept praying, you know, about it all and please help me. And I just, what was the phrase he kept giving me? Have faith. I was like, all right, that's really helpful. Thanks a lot. Have faith. Yeah, okay. So I held on to it. And this morning I was just feeling abysmal. So I came into the palace, big article to write for a new client. So I was writing that. And I messaged three of my close friends, the ones who gave me that Jane Austen tote bag in the background, three amazing Christian women and writers, and said how I was feeling. And they all just steamed in with fantastic support and advice and prayers. And the minute they did, all these coincidences started happening. So I pitched for a piece in Christianity magazine, got it. Something else happened. About four things happened, all one after the other, all saying, a friend of mine got in touch randomly saying, oh, I was down in the Hove Christian bookshop. They were saying how much they love your books. They were all talking about your books. They really love them. I was like, oh, okay. Somebody else ordered a book. You know, all this stuff happened. And I was lying there this morning thinking to myself, now I've been here before lots of times. This looks like a preemptive strike. It's the enemy trying to disable me to stop me doing something. So yes, it was a preemptive strike. It was to disable me so that I would talk to you and I'd be feeling really tired and discouraged and you'd ask me questions and I just give you really surface answers, instead of which I have said things that I would never normally say, actually. And that has now made me realize why the enemy was having such a go last night and today. Because he didn't want us having this conversation. And I've been doing this kind of stuff long enough to know that that means that at least one person, either who's listening to it now, when I say now, I mean when you put it out, or who will come across it, needs to hear something one of us said.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I'm just trying to discourage the cat. Look, you and I are going to fall out in a minute. Come on. Right, okay. She's gone a bit skittish. I know not why.
Maybe the cat's listening and saying, I don't agree with anything you're saying here. I'm going to put you off. I'm fed up. Boring.
Boring.
Move on.
Maybe.
Well, all I can say is thank you so much for your humility. I know we've had some fun and games, laughter-wise, earlier on, and then we started the podcast and it carried on. But wow, your honesty has been brilliant. And for those that have been really touched by what you've said and shared and want to get hold of you, Obviously, you've got a website. Please give it a plug and how they can contact you through it, please.
So the website is Ruth Lee Writes. That's Ruth, R-U-T-H, Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Writes, W-R-I-T-E-S, .co.uk. You can also find me on Instagram, Facebook, Threads and TikTok at Ruth Lee Writes. And you can email me, ruthleewrites@gmail.com. I simply love hearing from people. You know, I'm at that point now where I'm not yet world famous and I don't really have an entourage. So I've got time. If you get in touch with me, it won't be my people replying. It will be me. And I love it when people reach out and tell me stuff. And if this is helping someone, or I don't know if it's resonated with you, I really would love to hear from you by any of those means.
Wonderful. Although your lawyers had to talk to my lawyers to get this to where it is.
It's
just one of those things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ruth, thank you. Ruth Lee, who is your Christian hero, please?
I'm going to say Carrie Ten Boom. What a brave woman. Didn't have to stand up to people, but she did. Just an incredible woman in a very difficult time. Being incredible. I think she's amazing. That's who it would be.
And did Carrie Ten Boom like cats by a chance?
Who can say? I don't even like cats. I mean, that's a story in itself. I was terrified of cats. Literally used to leap out the way like a toreador when one came anywhere near me. And then her ladyship here was born in our garage in my husband's car. Yeah,
all
in
the really?
Yeah, yeah, really. We had no idea. And then she came out at 3 weeks old. We adopted her. And now we're cat simps, as the children say. I'm a complete simp.
What does simp mean?
It's a youth speak for someone who's really wet. You know, oh, hello, darling. Are you mummy's baby? I'm not that bad. But they say I'm a cat simp. But my husband is infinitely worse. He cuts up her food specially, talks to her like she's a person, carries her about like a baby. I mean, she lives a great life with us.
What do you know about Carrie Ten Boom? Especially for those that go, yeah, I've heard that name, but it doesn't resonate.
A Dutch Christian woman. She and her family, when the Nazis invaded, were taken to concentration camps. She had a sister who died in the camp. She had every reason to be bitter and angry and unforgiving. If ever a woman had a reason never to forgive the people who did those wicked things, it was her. And yet she somehow retained her faith. She grew in her faith. She wrote incredible books. The reason I mentioned her is because she was always coming up in the 70s when I was a young lass at church and Sunday school. She was constantly being mentioned. She was part of the fabric, if you like. And the story that I think most people will probably pull out of the many is the one where she was at an event and she saw one of the guards who had been particularly cruel. I can't remember if she'd become a Christian or if God said you have to forgive him, but she did. People talk a lot about forgiveness as quite a wishy-washy concept. You know, I've been guilty of this myself before I became a Christian. You know, I used to look at Christians and think, oh, you know, it's all a bit wet and a bit, oh, do-gooding.
A bit simps.
A bit simps, yeah. We have to struggle with such difficult concepts which are against our human nature. I mean, forgiveness is ludicrous. What a ludicrous idea. Someone is vile to you and causes you great pain, and you say, I choose to forgive you, instead of seeking revenge. That's ridiculous. And it's also incredibly hard. So anybody who can find the strength to do that and who can stick with their faith in God in the face of such suffering gets my vote.
Truly great person, Carrie Ten Boom. If people want to get the Isabella M. Smooge books, how can they get hold of them?
Oh,
please?
Listen, it's so easy to get your hands on my output. You can come to my website, click on my shop, and then you can just order it on there. It will all do it for you automatically. I will then print out a label, sign the book to whoever you like and dispatch it to you. You can go onto the many tentacled Amazon website. You can find me there, Kindle and paperback. I'm on Eden and Waterstones online. You can find me in all good Christian bookshops. Is there any other kind? But Google me, it'll all come up.
Ruth, thank you for an amazing podcast. Bet you didn't know it was going to go the way it had.
I didn't. Thank you.
God bless.
God bless.
Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
With my dad, a week later, we survived a small plane crash down in Idaho. And then the week after that, my mom sat me down on the couch. And she said, I'm leaving. Your father, I'm getting divorced. Your siblings, sister and two brothers, they're too little to really understand, so they're coming with me, but you're old enough to make a choice. So who do you want to stay with, your dad or me? And I couldn't really stay with my dad because he was still a traveling salesman on the road. But I was like, I'm staying with dad. That was the middle of July. By the end of August, she was gone. And she remarried 5 days, 2 weeks, something like that, after she left. So it was very, very rapid. My world went from, at the end of May, we're a happy family. At the end of August, I'm on my way to California to live with my grandparents. My dad's on the road and my mom is married to another guy. Probably one of the most traumatic events that has shaped my life.
So please join me in the next episode of Off-Grid Christianity with pastor and brewery owner, Christian Kreider. Until then, cheerio.